This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters, the show where we go behind the headlines and explore issues driving the press. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. As media outlets struggle to stay afloat in a difficult business environment, we are seeing more and more newsrooms forgo investigative reporting, which can involve a lot of resources without the certainty of a payoff. But investigative journalism is arguably the heart of what journalism for the public interest is all about. For a quick take on the importance of investigative journalism, I speak to Sonia Randhawa, co-director with the Center for Independent Journalism Malaysia. Hi, Sonia. Let's start off with defining what is investigative journalism, as opposed to regular reporting.
In many ways, there's not a clear-cut line always between investigative journalism and regular journalism, but it requires a lot more time to do an investigative story. It's a story that's more likely to be initiated by the journalist or by the newsroom. I mean, a classic example, which I'll bring up partly because I'm reading the book She Said at the moment, is the Harvey Weinstein case, where there had been rumours of sexual harassment in the company for years, and they tracked it down. It was an investigation that took years rather than, you know, even a couple of weeks. Now, that it was following a paper trail, and it's that investment of time and resources in a story, uncovering something that's hidden and holding power to account, which not all ordinary stories, as it were, do. And certainly most news stories don't have that investment of time and resources in them.
I mean, when you put it that way, is there any incentive from newsrooms to allocate resources for investigative journalism, especially in today's day and age where it's so difficult to sustain the business of a media outlet? Is it really just too much investment for too little returns?
I think that there are a number of strands to that question. Something that I've always wondered about is, and I think that investigative journalism is actually the answer to this, is what do newsrooms bring to a news story that you don't get from reading a PR news site, for example? And a lot of journalism today, it's very hard to tell the difference. And I know that there are great journalists doing great work and things like that where they do bring something extra to the story. Often it's background information, often it's the sources and things like that. But I think when you're looking at investigative journalism, that's where journalism really shows the difference between a news aggregator and a real newspaper. So that's one side of it. The second thing is the New York Times that did the Harvey Weinstein investigation got, first of all, from that, a huge number of stories as a result. It got a large amount of prestige for having broken the story, which helps to boost its circulation and its prestige more generally. And it also has other spin-offs like, for example, the book that's come out of it as well. And so there are various ways in which it can contribute to the bottom line. But I think that the third thing is there is a huge public interest in having resources into this sort of journalism, because we do need people who are paid professionals who are there to hold power to account in this way. And I think it is one of the justifications for public journalism in particular, and also for investment in journalism.
A kind of offshoot question. Does it matter who funds investigative journalism?
That's a really good question. I think that the countries that do the best investigative journalism have independent media funds. So, for example, in some of the Scandinavian countries, they have a tax on advertising, which is fed into a fund, which is then used to fund independent media projects, which can include things like short films, it can include a wide range of different things, and it can include investigative journalism. But it's not government, it's an independent body. Obviously, in Malaysia, we don't have a huge history of having quasi-government bodies which are actually independent of the government. But I think that's a really good model to ensure that the funds are there for this kind of journalism. Again, I'm repeating myself here, but journalism that holds power to account. It's not the only function that journalism has, and we recognise that. But I think it's a really important one, and it's one where public money could be well used.
What's your assessment of the culture of investigative journalism in Malaysia, especially given that it's no secret that media restrictions since the 1980s have had a chilling effect? But would it be correct to say that there's little investigative journalism?
I think that there have been some great stories. The 1MDB scandal and the role that The Edge played in that, for example, and Rage, obviously, is a key example of the role that investigative journalism can play in Malaysia. But it is so much harder when there are those restrictive laws governing the media. It is not an environment that's conducive to holding power to account when the same people that need to be held to account are the people that are making the decisions about whether or not you can maintain your license, whether or not you can be tried for sedition under very vaguely worded laws. So there are a lot of obstacles to a culture of investigative journalism in Malaysia.
That was Sonia Randhawa, co-director with the Center for Independent Journalism Malaysia. Now, a current real-life example of investigative journalism at work is the latest financial exposé by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, dubbed as the FinCEN Files. The ICIJ and its media members trawled through over 2,000 leaked bank documents to uncover the ways in which illicit money could flow through the international banking system. Malaysia Kini is one of the members of the ICIJ and reported on the Malaysian angle of the FinCEN Files. For a behind-the-scenes view on the process of investigative journalism, I speak to Aidila Raza, the Special Reports Editor with Malaysia Kini. Hi Aidila, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Malaysia Kini is one of the media partners of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Could you start off by telling us about the ICIJ and Malaysia Kini's membership with them?
Sure. The ICIJ is an organization that's based in Washington, D.C. in the U.S. They've got a small newsroom of investigative journalists, but they also work with a group of, like a consortium of investigative journalists around the world. So Malaysia Kini has been working with ICIJ for more than a decade now. Stephen Gunn, Malaysia Kini's founder, is a member of ICIJ and I am as well. And basically what we do is we work on projects which ICIJ lead when they have a story which they feel requires international input.
Are there fees involved? Is there some kind of contract between the two of you, or is this kind of a mutual agreement type thing?
Yeah, it's more of a mutual agreement type thing. There are no fees. We don't have to kind of pay to be a member. But what happens is they would approach journalists who they feel might add value to their investigation. And then we have to kind of put in an application and their team will evaluate whether we would actually add value. So, and then once we're selected, and then we're part of this consortium of journalists.
And apart from the FinCEN Files, which we will get to in a minute, have there been other kinds of cooperative reporting between Malaysia Kini and the ICIJ in the past decade?
Yes, actually, there have been a few. The first one that I was involved in is called Offshore Leaks, where similar to the FinCEN Files, is a dump of correspondence between confidential clients and lawyers in offshore jurisdictions. And we kind of went through that. So that was, I think, close to a decade ago, because it was quite early in my career. And then following that, we participated in the Panama Papers as well. And a recent one, Paradise Papers, and then this one.
And looking more generally about investigative journalism, so you work on special reports for Malaysia Kini, which focuses on these kinds of investigative stories. Could you maybe give us a sense of what that process in general is like? What does investigative journalism entail at Malaysia Kini?
I think I had to clarify that my role as special reports editor isn't always investigative. I feel like more of it is deep dives or longer read features, things that require a longer time to put together. So it isn't exactly investigative in a way that FinCEN Files was. But at the same time, it does investigate an issue further than what you see in the general headlines. So for, because Malaysia Kini doesn't exactly have like a dedicated investigative team, a lot of the work that we do at Malaysia Kini is more about doing deep dives rather than straight up investigations like the ICIJ.
But I guess there is a relation between the two in the sense that both deep dives and investigative journalism, they take a lot of time, yeah, which is different from day-to-day reporting.
Yes, absolutely. This is my second year in this role. And prior to that, I've been with Malaysia Kini for about 10 years. So although, of course, in my previous role, doing current affairs, I would have to do a lot of verification work and digging and everything, but never have I had to spend months on a project. Just having that stamina to stay with the topic for a long time, that is different from day-to-day reporting.
What do you think makes investigative journalism difficult? In your experience, what are some of the hurdles in trying to piece a story together?
On my part, a lot of it is resources. So I'm always having to kind of negotiate with the news desk, can I borrow a reporter to help me with my project? And that reporter will still be working on the day-to-day current affairs things. You know, it's a lot of work for a reporter to do a big investigative project as well as the day-to-day reporting. And even for me, I'm not just doing this full-time. I have to do several other projects alongside, and the people who are helping me on the tech side are doing the same thing. So for us at Malaysia Kini, it's always a resource issue. But at the same time, there are things like freedom of information, which is quite lacking in Malaysia. So we know that some states have it, although not so well used. But in general, for federal matters, I can't just ask and expect a reply. So it requires a lot of trying to find someone who may be nice enough to give me that information, or going through a lot of documents which may not even be properly filed or digitized. So that really just takes a lot of time. And sometimes, because we are so resource short, we are not able to pursue something because we don't have the time or the people to go through all that mm-hmm. to get the information. Yeah.
I'm speaking to Aidila Razak, the Special Reports Editor at Malaysia Kini. When we come back, we'll talk about the FinCEN files and Malaysia Kini's findings. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Hello, I'm Shazana, and if you've just joined us, you're listening to Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. On the show with me is Aidila Razak, Special Reports Editor with Malaysia Kini, and we're discussing the FinCEN files investigation, which made headlines last week. Could you give us an idea, or give us the broad picture of what exactly this document leak is all about?
In a nutshell, the FinCEN files is this document leak by an insider who gave this 2,100 documents, bank reports essentially, to BuzzFeed. And then BuzzFeed actually approached ICIJ to get some help with it because it's a lot of documents. What these documents are actually suspicious activity reports, SAR for short. SAR are documents which banks file to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, which is FinCEN, which is a bureau in the US Treasury. So they file this whenever they think that something's suspicious in the transactions. And FinCEN's duty is to kind of record all this data and then investigate suspicious dealings, money laundering, and such. So BuzzFeed thought that, okay, there's a lot here, and it involves the rest of the world, essentially. So we need more people working on it. So they approached ICIJ, and ICIJ developed like a system and recruited more journalists to look into it. And finally, we have the FinCEN files mm-hmm. story.
And the headline news coming out of the ICIJ's reporting on this was that $2 trillion US dollars worth of transactions, which were flagged as suspicious and could be linked to money laundering or criminal activity, this was actually flowing through the global financial system from 1999 to 2017.
Yeah, well, we should put a disclaimer here, and ICIJ has as well in all of its reporting, that suspicious activity reports are not indicative of that a crime has been committed. It's just the bank saying that we think something suspicious here. So it really is kind of the first step of triggering any sort of enforcement on these things. But as we see from the reporting, a lot of it was filed after the transaction has happened, and sometimes years after the transaction has happened, which kind of makes it a bit too late. Like you're trying to close the gates after the horses have bolted.
What counts as suspicious transactions?
It's a bit of everything. There's a whole list of kind of red flags that FinCEN has as a guideline. This could be things like having round dollar figures. So usually in transactions, things are not round figures. I mean, you would be ordering 100 things at 5.4 cents per unit, whatever. So your total amount would not be a round figure. So when it's a round figure, it triggers like suspicion that it might be for other reasons than that is stipulated. That's one. And it could be a lot of very similar transactions, which does not make sense. So you will have like 1,000 transactions from two entities, and then they say that it's for buying something. but then logically you wouldn't have to buy those things 1,000 times over the period of 1 year, for example. Or it could also be there is a case in court and the case is being reported in the media. So this officer, the bank is thinking, okay, these transactions might be suspicious because it's linked to that case in court.
Okay, so it covers a range of possible scenarios, really. And how does Malaysia feature in these FinCEN files? Because otherwise, it's easy to think, oh, this involves US banks, that's nothing to do with us. But I think your sifting through the documents actually found Malaysia implicated in this trove of documents.
Yeah, there are quite a number of Malaysian banks named in there, as well as Malaysian companies. The reason this is so is because they have a correspondent relationship with the US banks. When transactions are in US dollars, then they would require the US banks to assist them in clearing funds, etc. So this falls under the purview of the compliance officers that are looking at these transactions in the banks. That's why they get flagged. So it's a mixed bag in terms of how Malaysian parties are naming these documents. Most of it, I must say, that are relatively small transactions. I'm not talking 100 ringgit or 1,000 ringgit. A lot more than that could be in the millions, but relatively small compared to like the Jolo transactions of billions, which was also recorded in the documents.
What were the findings of the documents in relation to 1MDB?
The thing about the 1MDB ones, because you think that such huge transactions would have been flagged much, much earlier, at least when it happened. But a whole stack of the SARs or SARs that were filed related to the 1MDB transactions were only filed after the DOJ filed to say that we're filing this the largest kleptocracy case involving 1MDB. It was only then that the banks kind of went back to those transactions and said, oh, yeah, actually, we did facilitate these transactions. And in retrospect, they do look kind of odd. But this would be years after the transactions were made. Of course, we don't know if any of these eventually informed the DOJ case. And we know there are other cases still running and the actors in this scandal might still be indicted in court for other crimes. So it might not be too late, but it's a bit too late in terms of preventing it from happening. It's not too late for punishing the perpetrators, perhaps.
Talk to us a little bit about how you combed through the data. I mean, what was that like? I'm imagining you with like some magnifying glass, just looking through rows and rows of numbers.
Well, not quite a magnifying glass. So I worked on this with my colleague, Lee Long Hui. Basically, how the SARs look like, the first page would have the who are the beneficiaries, who's transacting this, what bank, dates, whatever. So those kind of details. But the meat of the SARs would be this part they call the narrative. And the narrative would be basically the story of this transaction. Some would be super interesting. So it'd be like, oh, this person is a known criminal, wanted in FBI, whatever, whatever. Some very juicy reading, but most of it is very, very dry. So that's the thing about investigative journalism as well. It's a lot of trawling through stacks of really dry documents. So there are hundreds of those. So you can imagine that there's 2,000 plus SARs, and then each SAR could be hundreds of pages of information. But some of them could be really short as well. Some could be like 2 or 3 pages. There wasn't really a better way to do it than to read them all. Unfortunately, we had just put up Malaysia and then tried to read as much as possible from there.
Goldman Sachs has so far been the only bank to face penalties for their role in the 1MDB scandal. I mean, based on these findings, do you think should more US banks be penalized for their involvement in facilitating transactions using 1MDB funds?
From a moral standing, you feel yes, but of course it depends on what the law says. Did you break the law by facilitating these funds? Did you do your due diligence? Things like that. The obligations of the banks over there is to file this SAR 30 days after they detected the suspicious activity. So they could argue that we didn't detect it until the DOJ filed their case, and then, oh, after that we filed. So it's a bit tricky.
I think anti-money laundering practitioners were raising the question that you said that, well, the banks were acting within their legal bounds. They weren't doing anything illegal. They felt that the reporting by the ICIJ unjustifiably painted banks with the black brush. But I think you also have a point in the sense that there's something that needs to be said about how banks are facilitating dirty money flows, and they can't just put their hands up and say, oh, but we did everything we could. In a way, I feel like the reporting shows that, well, there may be more things that can be done by the system overall.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of these kind of ICIJ projects kind of end up like that, the same as, say, Panama Papers. In lots of those offshore jurisdictions, and also the people who own those accounts in the offshore jurisdictions, they were not breaking any law. There's no law against Malaysians to own companies in offshore jurisdictions and things like that. So in a way, it's more like highlighting the flaws in the system rather than saying this person broke the law and they should be arrested. Yeah.
Well, Aidila, are we going to see more reports from Malaysia Kini on the FinCEN files?
We might, because the things that we published was really just a little bit of it. It's still a lot there to trawl through and see if there's any sort of information in there that might be interesting. The second story that we did on how the US bank said that Malaysia is named as a high-risk jurisdiction, that story was actually something that I didn't really want to file because I didn't think there was a lot of meat in there. But it turned out to be something that people were quite interested in. So that has made me think that maybe I should go through these documents again and see what am I missing.
We'll be watching this space then. Thanks so much, Aidila. I've been speaking to Aidila Raza of Malaysia Kini. This has been Pressing Matters on The Morning Run. We have the 10 a.m. news bulletin coming up next, and then the Enterprise team takes you through the rest of the morning. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.